Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Bringing together some 60 paintings drawn from collections around the world, Cézanne Portraits is the first exhibition devoted exclusively to this often neglected area of Paul Cézanne's work. His portraits were widely thought to be shockingly inept when they were first exhibited, but were understood by a small circle of artists and critics to be extremely radical works. In this lecture, held on June 3, 2018 at the National Gallery of Art, John Elderfield discusses how Cézanne's extended, methodical style of painting, one stroke after the other is how the artist described it, readily led to the creation of one painting after the other of the same subject. Elderfield also explains how indifferent Cézanne was to the personality or character of his sitters, long thought to have been necessary aims of portraiture, wanting simply to paint the objective, permanent presence of someone seen. Cézanne Portraits, in its sole American venue at the National Gallery, is on view through July 8, 2018.
Cézanne was famous, was notorious, is perhaps a better word, for his doubt, his anxiety while working that caused him to take a long time to paint his portraits. Be assured that this doesn't mean that this lecture will go on for a long time. I shall speak for about 45 minutes, briefly addressing six topics, and will name them in sequence so you can keep track of how am I getting along. And that said, let me begin with my first topic, which will start with a familiar first-person account of Cézanne's own acknowledgement of his difficulties. In 1904, a young painter and critic called Émile Bernard invited himself to visit the 65-year-old Paul Cézanne in Aix-en-Provence. Although Cézanne was often described as being antisocial and emotionally unstable, particularly in his later years, he does appear to have been kind and receptive to his visitors in this period, especially to younger ones, and he liked Bernard, even inviting him to join him as he painted. However, Bernard took a big risk one evening when, at dinner, he raised the subject of Honoré de Balzac's story, Le Chef d'œuvre, L'Inconnu, the unknown masterpiece, in which the elderly painter Fraunhofer is an exemplar of failure and madness, unable to complete a finished picture. Cézanne's reaction was immediate and startling. He got up from the table, Bernard said, stood before me, and striking his chest with his index finger, he admitted wordlessly by his repeated gestures that he was the very character in the novel. He was so moved by this feeling that tears filled his eyes. And it was accounts like this that shaped for succeeding generations the view that Cézanne's doubt in his ability to complete what he was painting was basic to his artistic psychology. And the most famous instance of how his anxiety about how he proceeded caused him to take an interminable amount of time to make a painting was his dealer Ambroise Vollard's report of 115 sittings for this 1899 portrait that then was abandoned incomplete. Although Vollard didn't publish this report until 1914, it seems more than likely that he told the story to Picasso and Matisse, whom we know had long been visiting his gallery. So our question would be, was it purely coincidental that in 1906, the year of Cézanne's death, Picasso claimed it took him 3 months and more than 90 sittings to complete his portrait of Gertrude Stein, a work indebted to Cézanne's portrait of his wife, then in Stein's collection. And when, in 1914, the year that Vollard published this story, Matisse in turn claimed that it took him over 100 sittings to complete his portrait of Madame Matisse, a canvas influenced by another of Cézanne's portraits of his wife. However, Picasso's explicit invocation of Cézanne's doubt came much later, in 1935, while defending himself against charges of facility. "Cézanne would never have interested me a bit," he said, "if he simply painted beautiful paintings. What forces our attention is Cézanne's anxiety. That's Cézanne's lesson." And this is a still often repeated statement. It was reinforced a decade or so later by the brilliant essay Le Doute de Cézanne, Cézanne's Doubt, by the philosopher Maurice Merleau-Ponty, a text that became deeply influential, even, perhaps especially, for those who had not read the text itself. Vollard had said it took Cézanne 115 sittings to paint his portrait. The first sentence of Merleau-Ponty's essay raised the stakes. It reads, "It took him 100 working sessions for a still life, 150 for a portrait." And not satisfied, an English language translator of Merleau-Ponty's text altered it to read, "It took him 500 sittings for a portrait." So what are we to believe? One thing we should certainly believe is that Picasso's and Merleau-Ponty's existentialist Cézanne, trembling with anxiety, survives in the continuing tradition of hyperbolic statements on Cézanne's difficulties. Hence, a prominent review of the present exhibition was titled High Anxiety. Now, this, I am sure you know, was the crippling condition suffered in the eponymous film by Mel Brooks, who played the director of the Psychoneurotic Institute for the Very, Very Nervous. Cézanne clearly retains the power to make some critics very, very nervous indeed. Cézanne himself, in his late years, did speak of difficulties while painting, which he attributed to his poor health and failing sight. He was diagnosed for diabetes before 1900 and would soon speak of suffering from vices of my optical nerves, especially when working in the heat of day. It was deeply frustrating to him on those occasions, he said, when his vision was not acute enough to follow the boundaries of objects where their points of contact are fine and delicate, from which it results that my image or picture is incomplete. Nonetheless, he accepted the trembling result in his watercolors made both in and out of doors and in his oils influenced by them. Such works reveal an extraordinary dissolution of fixed contours and with it an acceptance of incompletion not as a necessary evil but as a positive expression of visual contingency. It was in the late works in which he sought to eliminate the tremor that fueled the account of people like Bernard of Cézanne's difficulties. And we see this most clearly in works from the portrait of Vallée to the portrait of Cézanne's gardener above it, painted sometime between 1902 and 1906, and the large bathers, which appears behind Cézanne in this photograph by Bernard, which Cézanne had purportedly been working on for almost a decade, and attempting to solve the problems with the boundaries of objects, he painted and repainted contours to produce a crusted, grouting-like connection between adjacent forms. The mutual connection of adjacent forms had long been intrinsic to his painting. As one critic nicely put it, Cézanne never conceived of objects as individual things subsequently to be disposed about the canvas like articles of furniture in a room. His paintings are preeminently composed, knit together, interwoven into a single fabric, but before never so tightly. Now the figures are visibly seamed and sutured together. However long it took, nothing was allowed to be incomplete. The posthumous image of Cézanne as the doubting artist who painted slowly and painfully thus applies most legitimately to a finite group of oil paintings produced over a less than 10-year period of a working life of 4.5 decades. What then of the youthful Cézanne? We know from a letter written in November 1866, when Cézanne was 27, that he was making paintings of his uncle Dominic, and every afternoon there appears a portrait of him. One portrait after just one sitting every half day is probably an exaggeration, but they were not painted slowly. Because they were painted quickly, it's often assumed that they were painted impetuously, supporting the common idea that Cézanne was a passionate, overwrought artist in his early years before he became the more methodical and eventually doubting one as he matured. But it seems clear that he was the methodical and systematic painter in many respects almost from the start. The Uncle Dominic paintings can't have been vehement in their execution. They were painted quickly, but also painted carefully. They were composed from heavy, wet patches of paint applied by a knife, and it's impossible to do that in other than a careful manner without breaking the skin of previously applied such patches. What we see in these paintings was built up step by step in a confident, methodical way. A mason's painting is what one of his close friends called it. This process of setting down one patch after another became a process of setting down one brushstroke after another. It took Cézanne almost a decade to consolidate such an approach in similar, repeated, so-called constructive brushstrokes running diagonally across figure and ground, as seen in this self-portrait of around 1880. And once established, the patient, repetitive, and modular process persisted. It persisted even when Cézanne used thinner, more delicately applied constructive brushstrokes, and even when he combined them with a loosely painterly treatment, as in this mid-1880s portrait of his wife. And it persisted even when he abandoned such brushstrokes altogether, as in this turn-of-century portrait of an elderly woman, her face composed of lozenge-like patches like a map. As he said to a sitter, One stroke after the other, one after the other, was how he continued to work. And this was not the only heritage of the Uncle Dominic paintings. In those 9 or 10 portraits, a process of painting conceived of as a sequence of discrete operations was allied to a practice of painting involving the creation of one work after the other of the same subject. Cézanne was a repeater. He was a copyist, creating alike things, and a concatenator. That is to say, he created pairs and short series of alike things linked together as in a chain. Cézanne didn't have academic training in painting, which valued copying in the narrow sense of learning from esteemed predecessors by close replication of their works. However, he copied a lot, making around 300 copies in graphite, watercolor, and oil paint. Initially, he did so in the narrow academic sense, for example, with this early 1862 copy of a painting by Lancret, but he was soon copying in the broader sense of discovering his own style and delivery by building upon others, as in this copy of a Rembrandt that he made around 1870. He did, on occasion, make copies of his own paintings, and I will come to those later. But mainly, he made copies of what he painted, of its content, altering it to varying degrees to test the relationship of content and style of its delivery across pairs or short series of like works. This systematic, serial aspect of Cézanne's work, which began with the Uncle Dominic heads, is best known from his landscapes, still lifes, and bathers' compositions. And the process worked differently for the different subjects, depending on whether they were painted outside or inside the studio. Broadly speaking, in the case of landscapes, Cézanne made multiple paintings that offer alternative views of the same subject or the same subject seen from slightly different viewpoints. The paintings of Mont-Saint-Victoire are from 1902 to 06. In the case of studio still lifes, these date from around 1880, he rearranged and often modified the same subject to paint it in multiple ways. As for the bathers, also painted in the studio, these are from the mid-1870s, he combined the two approaches, offering alternative views of more or less the same landscape background and rearranging the figures as if they were elements of a still life. The component parts of his portraits could not, of course, be rearranged to the extent a still life could. And as we shall see, he generally avoided poses that looked arranged and therefore could be differently arranged. But when he painted more than one portrait of the same person, they could be as different as multiple landscapes of the same view. He wrote of his landscapes that painting the same subject from slightly different angles, as in this pair of landscapes from the late 80s, meant that the motifs multiply while the subject remains more or less the same. He adopted the same approach for this great two portraits of a man with crossed arms of 1899, which allow for the inference that the sitter held the same position while the artist shifted his view on him. And as with the Uncle Dominic heads, it's impossible to say which painting was made first. There are There are other paintings that imply which one was made first. An early example is Cézanne's two portraits of a friend, Gustave Boyer, made around 1870. And it's frequently been said that the smaller portrait without the hat may have been a study for the larger, bolder one. But we need to be careful about this. A pair of self-portraits of the mid-1880s resemble a traditional esquisse or freely pointed oil sketch preparatory for a tableau, the more densely worked image. However, the esquisse is as coherent and realized in its own terms as the tableau, an equal, different version of the subject, not necessarily a preceding preparatory work. And it's one of a number of such pairs of portraits of the same subject that look dissimilar, not because one improves upon the other, but because one is conceived differently to the other. Each one is an equally true account of the actual, of the presence of someone seen. And a large part of his portraiture practice involved acknowledgement of the differing presence of the same subject on different occasions. That wonderful phrase, a true account of the actual, was written by a man who died precisely at the time that Cézanne began making portraits, Henry David Thoreau. A true account of the actual, he wrote, is the rarest poetry, for common sense always takes a hasty and superficial view. What Thoreau was saying, though, was that there was more to reality than what a person can experience through their senses. This was a sentiment with which earlier portrait painters would have agreed. Therefore, they had to make a psychological as well as physical likeness of the sitter. In 1862, Cézanne took that position when he made from this photograph his first self-portrait. He was effectively asking himself, what is the difference between a hasty and superficial image of me, the photograph, and a true account of my presence, what I am attempting to paint? And his answer was to attempt to paint what his own image of himself was. His external image becomes the outward sign of his inward, clearly intense spirit. He would never do that again. It was not, he concluded, a true account of his actual presence. To paint the presence of someone seen meant insisting that there was not more, but no more to reality than what a person can experience through their senses. That first self-portrait is a very imposing work. Cézanne was really good at trying something and doing it very well, then learning from it that it wasn't what he should continue to be doing. An even greater work, his 1866 portrait of his father on the left, taught him another lesson. To make a true account of the presence of someone seen meant being as close as possible to that person when he was painting, as close as he was to his image of himself in the mirror when he was painting a self-portrait. So there would be very few portraits of a figure set within a room, showing the floor, setting the figure back in space. The figural image had to be right up to the surface, in fact, visibly on it. And in the present exhibition of the 60 paintings, there are only four, including the great portrait of the father where you can actually see the floor of the room. And we can follow here Cézanne advancing the figure to us from that portrait to that of his friend Achille Imperet, painted the following year. They're making a big jump forward a decade later with the great Boston portrait of the future Madame Cézanne. Now, it was a commonplace of earlier figure painting that the pose of a body could usefully be arranged so as to design the painting. The shape made by the pose and the composition of the picture would be mutually reinforcing. And Ingres' amazing portrait of Madame Moitessier, completed in 1856, is one of the great examples of this. One of Cézanne's four portraits of a boy in a red waistcoat, done between 1888 and 1890, exaggerates such approach almost to the point of parody. Another example of his doing something extraordinary while learning he didn't want to continue it. Postures or gestures that looked arranged, looked acted, assumed, and therefore untrue. The great Washington painting, often said to be reminiscent of Mannerist portraits, may derive from this Bronzino portrait of Ludovico Camponi, now at the Frick, which passed through a Parisian sale room in 1865. If that was the source, it helped Cézanne to bring the image up to the surface. And it produced a work of exceptional eloquence, which, along with its claim of companionship with the past, has made it, I think, the most popular painting in this exhibition. Nothing so tenderly affecting would be attempted again. We may, and probably do, think this is a great pity. However, it tells us that Cézanne's lesson for 20th century art included that willing renunciation of the beautifully pleasing that Leo Steinberg recorded as beginning with Matisse and Picasso. And to the point, I think, is that it was Modigliani who reputedly carried around a reproduction of this portrait in his coat pocket, neither Matisse nor Picasso. The remaining two portraits of this series are the more typical in their quality of disinterestedness. And if we think their matter-of-factness approaches that of mugshots, we will be interested to know that the Paris police started using Alphonse Bertillon's photographic mugshots about 5 years before these portraits were painted. What is mutually reinforcing in these portraits, now that acted gestures have been expelled, is the intimacy between the subject and the surface, the background and the figure alike brought up close to the surface. So, no psychology and a close-up image inseparable from the painted surface pretty much shaped the development of Cézanne's portraiture, which pretty much guaranteed that it would be misunderstood. The first misunderstanding began in 1905 with the critic Charles Maurice, who wrote that Cézanne has no more interest in a face than in an apple. Maurice was a translator of Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground, whose protagonist, a Fraunhofer-like figure, isolated in his failures from other human beings, insisted that a man in the 19th century must and morally ought to be preeminently a characterless creature. What would become a ubiquitous formalist reading of Cézanne's portraits thus began in the context of a proto-existentialism. The formalist reading would eventually be challenged by what I think is a second misunderstanding. Since all faces, unlike apples, do show some kind of expression, later writers have made much of reading the expressions on the faces of especially Madame Cézanne. However, this is not so straightforward a task as it may seem. First, different writers have read different emotions in the face on the left. It's wonderful. Well, these are both paintings from Philadelphia. Of the face on the left, and among them, melancholy, mournfulness, shyness, submission, tenderness, weakness. Self-evidently, this and other paintings are basically ambiguous in the affect that they convey. And if we do accept that, say, this face does convey one or more of these emotions, how can we know whether this is what Madame Cézanne is feeling, or whether it is what her husband thinks she must be feeling, or what he is projecting as his own feelings on her? Which leads to an unanswerable question. Did Cézanne ask his wife to assume particular expressions when he posed to her to be painted? Or did he offer her a means of presenting herself? I don't think we can draw a clear line in our viewing of such portraits between the painter's control and the sitter's self-presentation. Nonetheless, while all portraits are collaborations, we do, I think, have to attribute to Cézanne the uncertainties of meaning or variety of intimations, whatever we choose to call it, produced by these portraits. And finally, such meanings are not solely delivered by facial features. With the portrait to the right from the mid-1880s, the meaning, the feeling communicated by the delicately, let us say, lovingly painted bodice qualifies, to say the very least, one writer's blunt statement that she is rigid, pinched, angry. With this in mind, let us now turn from the reading of individual portraits to Cézanne's most developed linked series of them since the Uncle Dominic paintings of 1866. His 1880s portraits of his wife culminated in this sequence of four linked canvases of her wearing a red dress that comprised his fullest exploration of the process of concatenation. It's not only the red dress and the pose of the figure that links the four, it's also the shape of the head. And that links these four paintings to earlier portraits that Cézanne made. It had begun with his trio of self-portraits of the mid-1870s, whose most prominent feature was his now prematurely bald head. Of this, the critic Adrian Stokes remarked that, considering the wonderful volume he always achieved for the dome of his head, being bald on top was very fortunate for the artist. This wonderful volume is best described as the motif rather than the subject of these self-portraits, an identifiable motif that could be carried and transformed from one painting to the next. However, it wasn't solely a self-identifying motif, but one that he sought out in other subjects, most notably in his own family, thus marking them with his own identity. Hence, these self-portraits were accompanied and followed by a group of small portraits of his son's head, charmingly in reverse of his own, covered on top, but clean around the chin. And in these works, we see him examining how the integrity of the oval motif of the head could be preserved. And it was here that an unusual feature of his subsequent portraits began to emerge, namely that his sitters frequently appear to have only one ear. This would become most noticeable in his portraits of his wife in a red dress. And to follow the four changing versions of the oval head, each with a continuous sculptural contour on one side, is, I think, to experience it as a motif with the uncanny purity of a head by Brancusi carried on a head like a sculpture on a base. Moreover, the emphatic repetitiveness of each of these two pairs of works that comprise the series is emphasized by the strong possibility that copying was involved. This is to say that Cézanne probably painted the second portrait of each pair not directly from his wife, but by copying it in her absence from the first pair. And here is one pair. The central image shows the earlier painting on the left, overlaid on the later painting seen on the right. So you can see how closely their contours approximate to each other, and yet how different the result of the two works. And here, the image on the right shows the earlier painting above left, overlaid on the later one seen at bottom right. Now, in taking up his version of serial imagery, again in the 1880s, Cézanne was following a long-standing practice in 19th century French painting that began with academic artists copying their most popular compositions, and that continued through to the paintings of the Impressionists, most notably by Monet. Cézanne would have known of many of these precedents, as well as the work of printmakers and photographers whose mediums facilitated the production of series. And in making his portraits, the photographers would have been of particular interest to him for the obvious reason that they most frequently produce serial portraits, while the painters and printmakers hardly ever did so, concentrating on landscapes. Cézanne would have seen examples of serial photographs like this set by Disdary, and it's not unlike what we see, for example, in this set of Cézanne portraits of peasants from the 1890s. Unlike, say, Monet's series paintings, Cézanne's were made neither to meet market demands nor to complement each other in a display. He was hardly selling anything at the time and had virtually stopped exhibiting. Moreover, his were not conceived as a series, as a continuum, but with the rarest of exceptions, as pairs or sets of equal, differently imagined versions of the same subject. Still, like Monet's and other artists' series, they do express a move away from an aesthetic based upon the notion of a unique, inimitable masterpiece that was part of modern painting's first existential crisis. Another part of this crisis was the gradual abandonment of traditional conventions of painting as a craft in favor of quasi-mechanical means, exemplified by the repeated modular brushstrokes of Georges Seurat laid out as on a screen. Paintings by Cézanne with prominent constructive brushstrokes have similar quasi-mechanical implications, but as we saw earlier, they're reduced in prominence as his career advanced. I think, For this very reason, it was possible to have too much order. Around 1897, Cézanne surprisingly agreed to complete a questionnaire entitled Mes Confidences, My Confidences. Some of his replies are vintage grumpy Cézanne. Question: which foreigners are most agreeable to you? Answer: none. But one answer is very revealing. Question: what do you hope for most? Answer: certainty. In the early 20th century, before Cézanne's doubt became renowned, he was celebrated for his certainty as the great orderer, the artist who, more than anyone else, created post-impressionist order from the transience of visual appearances recorded by impressionist painters. One conclusion may be that his doubt, his anxiety, was caused by his hope for certainty. But it may be more useful to see him aiming for the certainty of order, yet recognizing, whether consciously or not, that it implied restriction, and therefore recognizing, whether consciously or not, the potency of disorder. As the anthropologist Mary Douglas famously explained for the cultural embrace of disorder, its potential for ordering is indefinite, and in the disorder of the mind lies truths that cannot be reached by conscious effort. And I think we see this in relaxations, tiny relaxations at times, a methodical order, sometimes merely in details of canvases like the Boston portrait at the left. Cézanne appears to have painted the lower right corner with a mind wandering from observed striped fabric to a remembered grove of trees. And we see it more dramatically a decade or so later in the Metropolitan painting at the center, where the background appears to be shifting in space around the figure. In the former case, the figure seems to respond by moving away from the disorder, in the latter by moving against it. The woman with the cafetiere of the mid-1890s at the right is probably the most ordered, weighty portrait that Cézanne painted. But even here, something disorderly is about to happen. That impossibly balanced vertical spoon in the coffee cup is going to fall down. We've seen earlier in this portrait from the early 1880s how Cézanne initiated a productive play between more and less articulate forms in the two juxtaposed zones of the painting, the light constructive brushstrokes that coat and model the head and neck, and for the bodice, the rhythmic cursive strokes that barely cover the surface, allowing the white open weave canvas to show through. Cézanne would continue to say that he worked systematically one stroke after the other, but disorder has been beautifully let in. In other works of this decade, he regressed to the traditional process of painting by setting down one layer after another. First, a drawn substructure. Second, a loose painterly infill to compose something akin to what traditionally would be called an ébauche, that is to say, the underpainting of what will become the finished work. And then, third, a more opaque finished surface. Here, in this portrait of his wife from around 1886, we see that he has stopped at the ébauche stage. However, we see this painting still hanging on his studio wall 7 years later, So he may well have pondered taking it further, then decided against doing so. We await more technical examination of Cézanne's canvases, say from the mid-1880s onward, to see if we can tell how frequently he worked in this way. But we do have the account of Cézanne talking to his friend, the poet Joachim Gasquet, in the later 1890s. Forgetting or forgiving his own early palette-knife portraits, he complained of contemporary painters, without naming any, who build up the paint straight away, go into action crudely like a bricklayer, and they believe that makes them stronger, more honest. What rubbish, he said. And what followed was a lengthy, beautiful defense of grisaille underpainting, of the freedom and vigor gained by the underpainting, the hidden soul of the underpainting, which links everything together and gives this strength and lightness to the whole ensemble. It creates, he said, a great pale world in rough draft. In the end, of course, he painted a great dark world in rough draft in the crusted portraits of which I spoke earlier, and what is beneath their surface we need to find out. He famously complained of the introduction of electric street lighting in L'Estaque because it spoiled the twilight. And we imagine that his last studio portraits, notably this pair of almost identical images of his garden Valier, were painted with and perhaps require as little illumination as the dark late paintings of Mark Rothko or of Rembrandt to which they have been compared. And their own darkness is a correlative of their stillness, what Roger Fry called a sense of monumental gravity and resistance, of something that has found its center and can never be moved. And that beautifully catches the power of their form. But there is also the formlessness in them. As Mary Douglas described her idea of society, there is a power in the form and another power in the inarticulate areas, margins, confused lines, and beyond the external boundaries. Cézanne's repetitive markings now produce in Keats's wonderful line, creations and destroyings all at once. Yes, these things may reflect Cézanne's doubt at his ability to bring a painting to a conclusion, or they may affirm the certainty of a belief that the power of a painting required him to remain duty-bound to what his artistic conscience was telling him, that come what may, his task was to search for the truth of the actual by painting and repainting the presence of someone seen, even if the great truth of the actual turned out to be that it was out of control. Of course, some of the later paintings are overworked and muddled, but Cézanne agreed with his admirer Delacroix, who wrote that easy won pleasure ceases to be pleasure, and easy works of art are like easy pleasures. They make little impression on those who look at them and also on those who have made them.
So John has agreed to take a couple of questions and or comments. Yeah, so the question is about Cézanne's use of open canvas, of patches of unpainted canvas, and incorporating those into his design or not.
I think it has to be a case-by-case response, because I think in some cases it does reflect his abandoning a picture. In other cases, The unpainted areas seem to live very comfortably with the painted areas, and in the portraits, it's interesting that there are few big areas of white canvas. In the later ones, they tend to be slivers. There are larger areas in the landscapes. Whether this is because they were painted out of doors, and there could be something as simply as practical as that it started to rain. There's things of that sort. And it's obviously a subject which has been beaten around a great deal by people interested in Cézanne, ranging from some people who believe that everything is complete because everything was put together, one thing next to the other, and each unit is complete, even if the whole painting isn't complete.
The question is, to what degree were the portraits commissions?
There were, I think, no commissions at all. He really wanted to paint people who he felt comfortable with, people who didn't want anything from him. And I think, he wasn't unusual in this. In his generation, there were more and more portraits of people by artists of their friends, rather than the kind of older tradition of commissioned portraits with that inevitable contrast of who's in control here. Is it the artist in control, or is it the sitter in control wanting to feel that he or she is being well represented? Cézanne just didn't want to deal with any of this. The couple of occasions when he seems to have been talked into or talked himself into something close to this, he had difficulties with them. Well, thank you so much for coming.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.